The problem that I've seen from Google is not bad product management. It's a lack of product strategy and alignment. They launch duplicative applications and they kill them. They launch stuff and they don't evolve them. They don't seem to have a cohesive strategy for responding to threats. And so it's almost like the leadership layer, the group product managers, the VPs and heads of product, they seem to come and go and not have a cohesive plan.
You're listening to the Startup Podcast. This is a Reacts episode. Industry insiders having frank debates about the latest tech, politics, and business news. Whether you're a founder, investor, or operator in a startup, you'll gain insights into how current events connect to broader themes and trends that impact your startup, your investments, and your day-to-day operational decisions. The conversation starts now.
Hi, I'm Yaniv Bernstein.
And I'm Chris Saad.
And in today's React, we're going to be talking mostly about Google and AI. So Google had their Cloud Next reveal today in their conference. They've talked about all the technology that they've released. I've had a go using Gemini 1.5 Pro. And I think, Chris, we think that Google is maybe on the march. We're going to dive into everything that they've done and why they're starting to look like a real contender in the AI race. Plus, we're going to talk about the exploit that nearly turned the internet into the plaything of a shadowy state-backed actor. All that and more on today's episode of the Startup Podcast Reacts. Stay tuned. This episode of the Startup Podcast is brought to you by Vanta. You might know that sinking feeling. You're about to land a big contract when they ask about compliance, SOC 2, ISO, PCI, Essential 8. You've just snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. Not anymore. Vanta massively accelerates your compliance efforts and allows you to get those life-changing deals back on track. Don't wait until it's panic stations, though. Get started with Vanta today. They're offering 20% off their prices just for TSP listeners. Do yourself a favor. Hit pause. Go to vanta.com/TSP. That's VANTA.com to get that 20% off.
All right. For our first topic, Yaniv, we want to go deep on Google Cloud Next 2024. This is Google's event revealing a lot of their updates to their Google Cloud infrastructure. This is really Google's business that's focused on Azure and AWS competition, right? This is for developers. It's about empowering developers to build, in this case, AI apps. It's all about AI. And they're calling it the new way to cloud. And they announced a whole bunch of stuff with a little bit of consumer stuff as well in the form of Google Workspace updates. So we thought we'd go through that, respond and react to some of the key announcements.
Like you said, to no one's surprise, this is really all about AI. I think maybe the lens that we can look through a lot of these announcements, Chris, is that the narrative, not incorrectly, is that Google has been caught quite flat-footed by the whole LLM AI revolution. And there's been a lot of negative talk about, can Google turn the ship around? And I think this is their attempt to do that. We can discuss how effective that's looking. And I think it also speaks to the angle that Google's taking, which is interesting and maybe a little bit surprising, which is that they are focusing their AI efforts seemingly more on the enterprise than on their billions of individual users. So as we go through some of these announcements, I think it would be good to tie it together with that thread.
I would say this is like AI month for Google and Apple, right? They both needed to make events or need to make events that tell the story of, hey, we're here and we're leading this AI revolution. And Google was up first and Apple is coming up soon. I think you're right on the narrative. The narrative is that Google's been a step behind, Microsoft especially. And I actually think looking at this event in totality, they've changed my mind today, actually. They have a full-throated and aggressive response here. There's a lot of stuff in production or about to be in production. And it is equivalent to, or in some cases, cleaner or more thoughtful than Microsoft stuff. You know, Microsoft's announcing a lot of acquisitions and a lot of partnerships and a lot of moves and a lot of stuff. But the Google story feels more coherent to me, more methodical and more, they've built a lot more stuff in-house because they had a lot of bits laying around. So they didn't need to do the dramatic theatrical things that Microsoft are doing, I think. I think it's a story of just slow and steady and pulling together what they've got and doing it well. So the first thing they tried to do was really tell a story of developer adoption. You know, they're saying, hey, many of these AI companies are actually using Google Cloud, Anthropic and Stability.ai and Mistral. They're like, you know, all those sexy AI names you've heard of, they're running on Google. And so that was their first story. And then their second story was, hey, you know, those big brands you've heard of, they're building apps, AI apps on Google, McDonald's and Mayo Clinic and Goldman Sachs and Mercedes-Benz. And so they're like, you know, Yeah, a lot of companies are doing a lot of announcements. People are using Google to build AI. I thought that was an effective way to start the conversation. And they also talked about data sovereignty, which was, you know, people think of Google as like, hey, your data is going to Google and it's going to become this big amorphous blob that Google can leverage. And I think to try to defeat that argument, they talked a lot about it's your data sovereignty. And these people are building apps on our platform using their own private data. So that was the first thing that stood out to me was Google is the platform of choice for all the major AI brands and major legacy brands. And let's start there.
It's interesting, and it makes me question, I think, some of my previous opinions and some of the things that we've talked about. Again, it's hard to argue that Microsoft has put a foot wrong. But when we look at AI, I think it's natural that, you know, we've been thinking more about consumer AI, right? Like, who's building the applications? Who's doing the really interesting stuff that seems to be impacting people's lives? And I think in that sense, the broader Microsoft umbrella, including, of course, OpenAI, seemed very far ahead, and Google seemed kind of quite flat-footed. But, you know, we did talk a couple of episodes ago, Chris, about what's Apple doing and also what's Amazon doing in AI. So if we move from the consumer space to the enterprise space and to that sort of enterprise AI infrastructure, it becomes a little bit less clear. Like, it's not clear that Amazon is ahead of Google. And it's actually, I'm not quite sure how far ahead Microsoft Azure is either, but it's a fundamentally different thing. And a lot of the value accrues to enterprise, right? I think this is really showing that Google's positioning itself as the AI cloud and probably has a pretty decent claim to that.
Yeah, look, I think there are three counter narratives to this whole thing of Microsoft's way ahead. I think the first is they've announced a lot of stuff. They've done a lot of dramatic things with OpenAI and so on. But Microsoft tends to do stuff in really janky, crappy ways. Like, I've been forced to use some Microsoft cloud stuff recently, you know, Teams and whatever. And I mean, it's just so janky and so junky. And so they may have just announced a bunch of features and dumped a bunch of features in the market, but like, does it all feel great and work great? I don't know, and I don't think so. The other is, I think Google, as I said, is doing this in a more methodical way. They have a lot more resources in-house. And so they don't need to do theatrical announcements around buying companies and doing deals. And as far as I can tell, what they're doing is they're doing it from the tech stack up. So they're upgrading their cloud infrastructure, they're upgrading their tooling, and then they're going to upgrade their applications. And that feels like the right way to do it in terms of building a reliable, thoughtful stack and actually being able to sell every layer of that stack to the market. And I think that's a very good idea. And then finally, I think both Google and Apple have been low-key AI companies for decades. They just haven't talked about it in those terms. Now, of course, what's changed is generative AI, and they're certainly going to have to prove that they're baking generative AI into all their technology across the whole stack. I just don't think you can count these guys out. Like, especially Apple, their nature is not to just say buzzwords all day long. Their nature is to say, what are useful applications for users? Very precise, very focused, very delightful experiences. And the fact that it's powered by some model underneath is less important. Now, because of shareholder perception, they will probably, in this WWDC, talk a lot about AI and buzzwords. But I don't think that's in their nature. And I think that's perfectly fine. That's what Apple does.
Maybe another way of looking at this sort of whole AI wars is really looking back to the company's DNA, right? Like, what makes them them? You know, I don't think anyone ever counted Google out. I think the allegation is that Google fumbled the bag. Google isn't just a low-key AI company. Google has been leading in AI and has been leading, more to the point, in transformers and generative AI on the research side for the past 10 years. And the question is, do they still have what it takes to commercialize that, right? Google's always been a technology-first, engineering-driven company in that sense, right? Like, Google Search was a technological breakthrough. Gmail, in a lot of ways, was a technological breakthrough. They're less of a product company and more of a, like, let's have technology and wrap product around it sort of company. And it sort of looked like they were caught flat-footed. But I think one of the things I've kind of been the naysayer here in our discussions with you and Emil, Chris, is that sort of slapping AI into consumer applications is proving to be a lot harder to provide utility than one may have thought. And, you know, that my favorite example is Notion, because Notion's just sticking AI into every nook and cranny, and it's just not useful. But I think that's true in general, that trying to sort of wedge these LLM bits and pieces into existing applications doesn't really work very well. And so given that that seems to have played out, I believe, this puts Google in a much stronger position, right? Because yes, they've got the tech, they've got the infrastructure, they are a fairly big player in cloud, albeit a challenger brand, but they're a fairly big player in cloud. And they can now say, okay, we don't have to move quickly on this. We can, like you say, Chris, work from the bottom up, because the consumer applications aren't going to run away. You know, it was just a few months ago, I don't think this is totally settled, but the hype has quite died down, the real question about Google was like, is this going to kill search? Do you remember that, Chris? Like, the thing was, Microsoft came out really quickly with ChatGPT integrated into Bing. And then there's Perplexity AI, which is incredibly cool and so on. But the thing is like, you know, is Google just going to be subject to a massive platform disruption? They released Bard. Bard was kind of shit. Right. And so everyone's like, you know, Microsoft's going to eat Google's lunch. Bing is going to be the new Google and so on. And again, I just don't think that's happened. Search turns out to have utility. And so Google just has more time. And that really plays to their advantage. And I think they're doing it smart, reasonably smart, at least. I think it's too early to declare victory. But the other thing, Chris, I'd kind of draw your attention to is Google Plus. I lived through the Google Plus fiasco, right? And what happened there was that Google freaked out, in particular, Larry Page freaked out about Facebook. This was peak Facebook, and they were growing like crazy. And the concern was, in the same way that the recent fear is about LLMs and generative AI eating search, they were like, Facebook's going to eat search because everything's social and whatever, right? And like, even search is going to be social. And so they're like, we need to respond. And their response was, let's basically build a shitty Facebook clone. And even inside the company, there were so many people saying, hey, we've got all the data. We've got Gmail, we've got maps, we've got so much data about people. Let's actually create a platform around that data because then we'll be unstoppable. But that's not what was done. There was this panicked knee-jerk reaction, and we all know how that ended up. And so one view of this is they've learned their lesson a little bit, right? I mean, not completely. They did launch Bard, but they're like, hey, instead of trying to go top down, let us use our infrastructure advantage and cement that in and not just sort of submit to panicked knee-jerk reactions.
Yeah, Nev, you know how Google operates from the inside better than I do, or at least during the era that you were there. But from the outside, I perceive Google to have what I would describe as great product management, but really shit product strategy. You know, their web apps are way, way better than Microsoft's web apps. Like, I'm being forced to use Microsoft's Office 365, so it is junk. And I'm trying to like edit stuff and collaborate on stuff, and like pieces move around and fonts change and things stretch and fields get locked.
Sorry to interrupt. This is my engineer in me. That's not to do with product management. That's actually to do with engineering. And again, Google basically invented the web app, right? And for whatever reason, creating a dynamic, collaboratively edited document in the cloud is not easy. And Google Docs was doing it first. Again, it's a better technology. It works. And I think that's a real advantage.
Product managers have to give engineers the time and focus to build things that are great. And so if the product managers said to the engineers, the experience of this web app needs to be of this quality and of this nature, the engineers would be able to figure that out. So I don't think that they're putting the right emphasis on the web experience and giving the engineers the time to do a great job. I actually think a lot of Google apps are simple, they're human, they're elegant, and they work very nicely. They're well designed. They are great illustrations and animations. The problem that I've seen from Google is not bad product management. It's a lack of product strategy and alignment. They launch duplicative applications and they kill them. They launch stuff and they don't evolve them. They don't seem to have a cohesive strategy for responding to threats. And so it's almost like the leadership layer, the group product managers, the VPs and heads of product, they seem to come and go and not have a cohesive plan. Yep. And again, what I'm seeing with the implementation of AI, generative AI into Google's apps, in this case, workspaces, just feels great. It feels really great. It feels really clean, really slick. And I think it'll end up working much better than a lot of Microsoft's junk. I'm also kind of surprised in terms of the consumer side that we're not hearing more about Assistant. The moment Google decides to bake Gemini into Assistant, you will then have a large language model embedded into people's homes and TVs. That is a kind of distribution that Microsoft does not have. And the same is true for Apple. As soon as Apple decides on their large language model strategy, you will have a large language model in people's ears through these little things here and in their HomePods and in their phones across billions of devices for billions of users. And that is an advantage that Microsoft does not have. And OpenAI, when they will inevitably launch their hardware device, is going to be starting on the back foot. So I really think this is the first innings of a very, very long game. I'm extremely excited to see where it is. And I'm putting my money where my mouth is, frankly. I'm investing in Apple and Google, even though they haven't experienced the generative AI bump. And actually, Google's stock is responding today to their announcement. So that's pretty cool, too.
Yeah.
So let's continue to unpack the announcements now that we've talked about the high level. One of the first things they focused on was Gemini 1.5 Pro, which is now in public preview. They're very excited about their huge 1 million token context window. They're very excited about its multimodal nature. And the examples they gave were, hey, an insurance company can just dump all the video and text and audio from a claim and then automate the claim process, which you can't do, of course, with a much smaller context window. What I did find interesting, though, is, you know, they had Goldman Sachs' CEO talking about how this is amazing at Goldman Sachs. And this is an example of hype over substance. If you listen very carefully to what he's saying, he's like, hey, we're just now entering the practical application phase and it's showing the potential for having a real impact. And we want to be thoughtful about how we develop the technology or deploy the technology. So there's a lot of caveats there, right? It's like, it's just now sort of practical and it's showing the potential to have high impact on the business. And we want to be thoughtful about. So at least at Goldman Sachs, but I just thought, you know, he's on the keynote. He's still talking about potentiality, not about reality.
But actually, let's talk about Gemini 1.5 Pro, Chris, because I've actually had access to the limited preview thanks to Ali, who was on the show before. He got me in and I've been playing with it. And I am actually a little bit blown away. So I've used ChatGPT 4, you know, I pay for that. I tried a bunch of different LLMs and they're really cool. But one of the reasons for my slight skepticism has always been when I try to use this stuff for my actual work, it falls a little bit short. It sort of still has been in this magical novelty, uncanny valley, right? I'm like, oh, can this thing help me write social media posts? Can it help me write useful documents? Can it help me understand things about the world? And I'm like, not quite. So I did two things with Gemini, which I think really kind of impressed me. So the first is, Chris, we actually got given the draft of a book. We had an author reach out to us or their publicist saying, hey, would you like to have this author on the show? They've got an upcoming book. And they're like, and here's a PDF of the pre-release. And I'm like, I'm not sure I have time to read this whole thing. I'd love for someone to read it and give me Cliff's notes. And so, you know, with Gemini 1.5 Pro's big context window, I was like, read this and summarize it to me in about 3,000 words with relevant quotes. And it did that. And I kind of validated it a little bit. It seemed really accurate and quite insightful in a sense. I was like, highlight some of the more controversial or contrarian takes. It did that well for me. So that's one. And then the other is, I had an idea that I wanted to create a LinkedIn post with a sort of a carousel with some of the best quotes about decision making. And this is an area I know about, right? It's not like I'm just sort of on a total fishing expedition, but I'm like, what are some of the best quotes on decision making and who made them? This is the sort of post I want to write. And it came out with this long list. First of all, they were great. And second of all, there was no hallucination. I checked all of these quotes. They were legit. And so as a research tool, I'm like, okay, this is now amazing. You know, I still don't think that fully AI written social media posts are possible or desirable. But when I knew what I wanted to do, it massively accelerated and basically improved the quality of what I could create. And so I see myself using this tool in a way that I wanted to use ChatGPT for, but it couldn't quite do things for me. And Chris, this comes back to what we're saying about Google, is they actually have the best technology in this space, or at least they're right up there. You know, you talk about, okay, in the home, you've kind of got Google, Apple, and Amazon with the home assistants. Well, between those three, putting Microsoft and OpenAI and Mistral and all of those guys out of the picture, there's actually a really clear leader in terms of who has the best model, and it's Google.
That's right. I mean, I started off my home assistant journey with Alexa, and I was like, this is kind of janky, and I have to turn on all these skills, and they don't really work, and I switched to Google. And I've been using Google Home for the last, I don't know, decade. It's incredible. It's really, really great. And when you add generative AI, I'm so excited about my Google Home Gemini update.
When you add good generative AI, like, I mean, I think there's a reason why nobody's done it yet, which is it probably sucks a bit too much.
Yes.
But
well, I think where the challenge is going to be is at the intersection of the smart home functionality and the generative AI responsiveness. So it's like, where do you hand off between the generative AI stuff and the functional stuff? And how do you make that feel seamless rather than two things that are just glued together?
Yeah.
And I think that they're probably spending some time to make that really, really great.
But yeah, I guess just to finish off my thought, this big context window, it really makes a difference. And I also think this hallucination problem is looking like it's been solved. Like, if you can get things to read a book and give you pertinent quotes and they're accurate and you can rely on them, then that starts to become really interesting.
Well, that's a good segue into the next topic, actually. So the next part of the announcement was their updates to what they call Vertex AI, which is really three or four things in one. It's a marketplace of models, it's a model builder, and it's an agent builder. I think the agent builder piece was the main new piece here. They've got this thing they call the Model Garden, which is a kind of cute name for really just an app store, a marketplace to browse and select and provision models. There's the model builder and then the agent builder. And the agent builder allows you to train and tune these models. And here's the big one. It allows you to ground the agents into custom data, something they called enterprise truth, which I like is it's, you know, the enterprise databases and data sets. So any answers for employees or for customers of a company can be grounded in that company's truth. And they also talked about the ability to ground the agent in Google search, which they explicitly said significantly reduces hallucinations. And so I think when you point the agent at a specific knowledge base, whether it's your enterprise truth or Google search, the hallucination problem becomes far, far less impactful or important. Because the model, I think, really just hallucinates when it has no earthly idea what you're talking about and it has nowhere to go and look. It's trying to be helpful. And so it just kind of makes stuff up.
Yeah. Models don't know how to say, I don't know. So they will always give you an answer.
Yes, that's right. I think that's a great way of putting it, which is there are some human beings, you know, who don't like to say, I don't know. They think it somehow makes them weak or makes them seem not as intelligent. And the reality is saying, I don't know, is very powerful and very useful and very credibility building. And so the models seem to be one of these humans that just don't like to admit they don't know anything. And yeah, so if you give it the knowledge, it is much, much less likely to just make shit up.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the acronym you're looking for here is RAG, which stands for Retrieval Augmented Generation. And that's something that is becoming like the sort of the next frontier of LLMs. I think Perplexity AI does a lot of this stuff, which is exactly what you say, which is if you give the LLM the ability to search, and I think there's, you know, quite a lot of technological underpinning as well, then it can give you much better answers. And again, Google has all of the raw materials. So the argument, I think, has been this is Google's to lose. And maybe what they're doing, they're turning the narrative here is they look like they were going to lose it. They look like they were so flat-footed and poorly run, they were just going to get run over. And now it's like, okay, you know, they've got all of the raw material. And as long as they move methodically and thoughtfully with some decent amount of product strategy, to your point, Chris, they're actually in a really strong position to be a dominant player here.
And not only are they leveraging their underlying technology bits, they're actually leveraging Google search, you know, named and directly referenced. So that it's kind of like, hey, you get all of this great tech and Google search. So one of the examples I saw was looking for a shirt. And what the developer advocate was showing on stage was, hey, all of the reasoning and interpretation and grounding is brilliant. It's new and it's the new stuff we're shipping. And look at this great search result. It's powered by Google search. And so it's, you get Gen AI plus Google search. Right, that's right. It's better than Bing. And so I really, really like it when these product strategies, when these companies say, hey, what are the things people love about us? And how do we add it into the mix as peanut butter and jelly so that we can use our unfair advantage to beat the competition? And this is the thing that I think you and I keep talking about Google Plus over the last, you know, many episodes. That's the thing that Google didn't do with Google Plus. You know, you talk about the internal struggle to use the data. From the outside, I wrote this long article that I could tell from my analytics made the rounds at Google. What I was arguing is they didn't use any of their surfaces. They didn't use Google Search, Gmail, Google Sheets, Google Docs. And so they have this news feed with no distribution. They refuse to use their core attention surfaces to drive eyeballs to that news feed, which would make then the news feed valuable, which would then make my investment in that news feed valuable. And so they didn't use their core data, their core tech, or their core surfaces. And here they're saying, no, no, we got Google Search, we got Google Meets, we got Google Workspaces, we got Google Tech, we got Google Cloud, and we are going to embed AI everywhere. And they haven't even mentioned Google Assistant. And I cannot wait. That'll be the death blow, I think. Where it's like, yeah, Microsoft, you got Enterprise. We are in people's homes and we're in their pockets. So how about them apples?
Well, you know what? I think this conversation, I'm getting a bit Google-pilled. I think I might log off and try to buy some Google shares. Because, okay, here are some things that have come together in my mind. You know, I feel that Google, in a lot of ways, has been a bit of a dysfunctional company and lost its way for a while. And that's been the dominant narrative in my mind. But what we're saying here is a few things. My view is Google has always been a technology-led and engineering-led company. And what that means is, if you look at all its great product successes, they have come from superior technology. I agree with you, their product strategy tends not to be very good. I also am somewhat skeptical about the quality of their product management at times, but the best Google products have a core of good technology. And the last few years haven't given Google much opportunity to flex the technology side of things, right? They've been in all these spaces where really what you've needed to have is exceptional product strategy, exceptional distribution strategy, and that has not played to its strengths. But what this conversation is reminding me and making me realize is generative AI, as much as it's been seen as like a threat that has caught Google flat-footed, it is bringing the playing field back into Google's home ground. They're like, damn, okay, so now we're competing on technology. Hold my beer, right? Because we have got the technology, and not just in general, but we've got the technology that matters. We are the leaders in transformers and LLMs, not in commercializing them, not in creating consumer products from them, but in terms of the core tech, yeah, we're the leaders. We're the leaders in search. You know, if Google's mission statement has been to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible, that was their mission statement, right? Organize the world's information and make it universally accessible. You know, for a long time, that just hasn't rung true. That hasn't really been, if you look at what Google does, you can't be like, you know, most of what they do, most of their product innovation is based around that. But, you know, that was about search. And now we're at LLMs and we're like, oh, okay, this starts to become relevant again. This starts to become pertinent again.
Yeah, but I think Google has done a great job of this. It's just that we take their stuff for granted. Google search and YouTube search, actually, and a lot of the features baked into Assistant and Android, they have organized the world's information and made it universally accessible and useful better than anybody else. It's just that they haven't done anything earth-shattering recently. And so I just want to give them credit that they made a massive impact on that problem. We got comfortable and used to it, and it became like wallpaper. And as you're correctly pointing out, there is now a step function change, a breakthrough in the tooling and the possibilities for organizing the information even more effectively. And Google, as you said, is just like, hold my beer. We can now add this to our mission, and we are best positioned to crush this.
But, you know, you said we got comfortable, and we did, but they got comfortable too. And, you know, I never bought into the narratives of like Google search used to be great and now it sucks. That is people just getting used to it. That is hedonic adaptation. Like Google search was amazing, still is amazing. Sure, maybe a few too many ads, but it's amazing, right? But they got complacent. In fact, I remember when I was still there even, machine learning, which is I guess what they called AI back then, like Google's search algorithm was hand created, right? There was an internal team that was using machine learning to change the ranking algorithm, and they could show that the results were better, but they didn't get approval to launch it because there was this strong sense of like, we need to have understandability and control over the ranking algorithm. In the meantime, Bing just went full machine learning. And that's why they got as close as they did in terms of search quality to Google. And so I think what happened is it's a standard incumbency issue where they got complacent. You know, there was this golden goose and you didn't want to kill it. You don't want to disrupt yourself. I mean, you do, but it's uncomfortable to do that. And so Google search, I think, while it's still amazing, hasn't evolved all that much in a long time. And all this great AI stuff was happening inside the company. And I think what many people, including myself, were worried about is, I guess what you'd call like the curse of the research division. Like there's a long history of companies that have incredibly innovative research departments, and they come up with all of this cutting edge technology, but it never makes the leap from that company's research department into that company's commercial operations. So, you know, I think starting with IBM research, you know, IBM is a moribund company that isn't relevant anymore. Xerox PARC basically invented the modern graphical user interface, but they didn't commercialize it. Apple did, right? Microsoft research, during that period when Microsoft was in the doldrums, Microsoft research was coming up with all sorts of cool shit, like the HoloLens and the Surface and so on. Again, couldn't be commercialized. This is a very common problem when you have these sort of pure research and it's not well integrated into the company. And so the question was with AI is like, is Google gone down this path? It's like, yeah, they'll create all the technology, but they will not turn it into a product. That's what it was looking like. That is the narrative around them being caught flat-footed, which I do believe they were, is that they were too complacent to take this amazing technology they had and push it hard into their products. But I think the good news for them is they got the wake-up call. They've responded in a way that is not too knee-jerk and stupid. And the evolution of the technology and the product landscape of this technology actually means they've got time to catch up on the product side. Like OpenAI is really cool. They haven't run away with it. Google search is still dominant. So, you know, they've got time. And if they are methodical, then they can use that massive technology advantage to catch up, to overtake, and to be one of the real winners from this revolution. This episode of the Startup Podcast is brought to you by Vanta. The team at Vanta are passionate about helping you secure your business by vastly cutting down on the time to get compliant with frameworks like ISO 27001, SOC 2, and Essential 8. Vanta lets you close deals, sleep better at night, and get back to building your product. Help yourself and help the podcast by going to vanta.com/TSP for an exclusive 20% off deal.
So they also announced a bunch of other updates, specifically updates to Google Workspace. You know, there's a bunch of the Google Meet stuff you'd expect, transcription, note-taking, summarization, a lot of write for me features, a lot of, hey, across these docs, tell me what they're talking about, catch me up. This is all stuff that you would expect to be baked into all their productivity tools. And, you know, as I said, they're catching up fast. They're baking it in. Frankly, it looks more human, more glossy, more usable than Microsoft stuff because Microsoft doesn't know how to build web apps to save their life. They also launched Google Vids, which I haven't had a chance to dig right into, Yanev, but it's AI-generated video creation tool that seems to be right alongside Google Docs and Google Sheets. I'm very excited to play with that, and I want to learn more about that. They've done Google Code Assist, which is obviously their like GitHub Copilot equivalent. I think they've relaunched or made available Imogen 2, which is that one that generated all that controversy about black founding fathers and stuff. And I guess the other key point here is that their stock is up at the moment. Trading's still open, but it's up 1.2% today, and for the week, 2.75%. So I'm a happy Google shareholder, and they're moving in the right direction. But again, I think both Google and Apple still haven't really benefited from the generative AI bump. You know, Google's been certainly going up and to the right in a straight line, but they haven't been experiencing a serious bump the way that I think that they may when this thing rolls out properly and you realize that Apple has Siri and Google has Assistant and these guys have serious consumer distribution.
Okay, so let's switch to the next topic. I wanted to talk quickly about this XZ backdoor because I think it's a rollicking story and also tells you something about the nature of the internet, which I think is just important to know. So what this is the internet, as we know it, all the cloud, is based on Linux. Now, Linux is something that you may not hear about that much anymore because it's kind of been abstracted away, right? But Linux actually powers the entire internet. And one of the main tools in Linux that joins all of these machines together and is used for administration is SSH, which stands for Secure Shell. That is how you can remotely log into a Linux machine or any Unix machine in order to, you know, interact with it.
It's basically remote desktop for Linux, right? If you've ever had a customer support rep control your mouse on Windows to help you fix your thing, this is the same thing, but for Linux terminals, it allows one computer to access and control another remotely, right?
That's correct. And so basically every server in the cloud has an SSH service running on it. And SSH, like Linux itself, is open source. What that means is it has maintainers who are people who like maybe originally wrote it or took over the mantle of running this thing. And anybody can contribute code, but it is up to the maintainers to accept that code and then release it into the broader Linux or SSH ecosystem, right? So we've got all of the world's computers, trillions of dollars, like the entire economy running on top of this open source stuff that's often maintained by volunteers. And it gets deeper, right? So Linux, of course, these days is really important. It's maintained by commercial maintainers with links to Amazon, with links to Google and so on. So is SSH. But the thing is, all of these have dependencies, right? So if you use SSH, SSH itself uses other open source libraries. And some of these are not particularly well maintained, or they are rather maintained by volunteers and amateurs. And one of the libraries that SSH uses is called XZ. Now, what it does is not particularly important. The important thing to note is it is maintained by the community. Anybody can make contributions to it, and the community maintainers were vetting them. Now, this is a thankless task. It doesn't pay. So what happens is, you know, over time, people start to lose interest. And so what happened is there was a multi-year state-sponsored social engineering attack on this XZ library. And the way it worked is a few years ago, somebody started contributing useful code, useful upgrades to the XZ library. They weren't the maintainer, but the maintainer was like, oh, this is good stuff. And over a period of years, they built trust with the maintainers. And then eventually the maintainer got sick of maintaining this XZ library. And they're like, I'd like to retire from this job. And this person or this actor who's been helpfully contributing over a course of years put up their hand and they were like, hey, I wouldn't mind being the maintainer. I'm happy to do that. And they were like, cool. So suddenly this person has had their privilege escalated from being a contributor to being a maintainer of the library. A bit more time passes. And again, they're acting in good faith. But over time, they allow these little bits of code to sneak in that build up to creating a backdoor. That means that through this library, the state-sponsored actor can basically get into every server on the internet using this carefully crafted backdoor. So this is really fucking cool and really terrifying, right? Where you see how kind of the open democratic infrastructure of the internet, the vulnerabilities of that can be exploited by well-funded state actors. And by the way, we don't know what country this is, but you can make some guesses. Now, the crazy thing is these changes were basically being integrated upstream, meaning they were about to be released into SSH across the world. And then there was this engineer in Silicon Valley, your classic kind of nerdy Unix engineer. And he noticed something when he was playing with SSH, he was benchmarking it, meaning he was checking how long it took to log in and stuff. And there was something that just wasn't sitting right with him. It was taking a little bit longer than usual. And so he did all his technical profiling and stuff. And he started identifying, it's like, hey, this XZ library, it's gotten slower than it used to be. So whenever SSH uses XZ, it's slower than it used to be. And then he just followed his hunches. He's like, there's something wrong here. And he looked, and because he is very skilled, he found this concealed backdoor in the library, and he stopped this release from going upstream. So it nearly reminds me, you know, there's a story from the Cold War where there was this Soviet nuclear attack system that malfunctioned, right? It was saying that the Americans had launched the nukes at the Soviet Union, and the guy in charge, basically, his orders were like, if that happens, you know, immediate retaliation, launch the whole nuclear fleet against the US. But he was like, something doesn't look right. I think this is a false alarm. And he didn't press the button. And by doing that, he saved the world, basically. And it feels the same in the sense that, I'm not saying it's quite as dramatic, but this was 1 minute from midnight. If this had gotten through, like, the internet would have been completely compromised. And it was thanks to the actions of this one single engineer following a bit of a nerdy hunch based on something going a bit slower than it used to that thwarted this plan. I reckon that's really cool. I reckon it's also really terrifying. And I think it is an important bit of knowledge for people to have that the internet isn't this like sleek spaceship. It's this rickety contraption that's been cobbled together from decades of contributions from individuals all over the world. And it is loosely governed. That is its strength, but it's also its weakness.
It's some like spy thriller novel shit.
Crazy shit. Also, by the way, a little bit of sympathy for the evil nefarious actors. They spent years coming up with the perfect plot, only to have it thwarted by some random guy. They must be really bummed.
Yeah, I mean, this is literally, you could imagine this being the first chapter or two of a spy thriller novel, right?
Yeah.
Talking about this deliberative multi-year plot to crack the internet. It really does reveal that in some ways, in some cases, the world is really hanging on by a thread. Like, there are these little threads that you can pull on, sometimes managed or maintained by these thankless jobs in missile silos or in maintainers of arbitrary, obscure pieces of open source code. And there, but for the grace of God, there for the grace of some nerd in some basement somewhere, the $1 trillion economy keeps running and nuclear missiles stay in their silos. And
kind of amazing.
It's quite incredible. You know, also just to take this more broad, you mentioned the internet is running on open source code and open source protocols and consensus, and that is its strength and its weakness. That's true, at least in theory, of Western democracy as well.
Mm-hmm.
That's also its strength and its weakness, right? And, you know, we've seen a lot of, let's call it, weaknesses emerge. We've seen a lot of cannibalization. We've seen a lot of weaponization of those systems, of those institutions, and of those processes like free speech. And we've seen a lot of people, especially young people, but maybe also older people with less memory and intelligence, question the efficacy or the relevance of democracy and talk about like, well, geez, we need a strong man to control this thing, and we need fewer rights for women, and we need more control of speech. And it just struck me, as you said, that's its weakness and its strength of the internet. It's the weakness and strength of liberal democracies everywhere.
It speaks to the need to defend these things. And I'm not one of those total pessimists, right, where the world's going to hell in the handbasket. I don't believe that's true. I believe that democracies and liberalism is an incredibly powerful force. And actually, if you look at the US and the Western alliance, in a lot of ways, it's as strong or stronger than it's ever been, you know, economically, technologically, and so on. But they also have vulnerabilities. And for those of us, which is all of us who benefit from these things, it is incumbent on us to actually help fight those vulnerabilities, to strengthen those democracies so that we don't have to give up and say, ah, well, this democracy is too weak. We need a different system to protect ourselves, because, you know, that's kind of like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And similarly with the internet, with this sort of open technology, we really want to be investing in that. I think it's the craziest, coolest thing that open source has taken over the world, so much so that it doesn't even get talked about anymore because it's just part of the natural order of things. But we need to respect that, and we need to make sure that we have strong systems in place so that we can keep doing things in that way.
Yeah. So, I mean, I must admit, sadly, I've become much more of a skeptic in the last 5 years, 10 years. I really feel like US democracy, at least, has been increasingly revealed to be a lot of theater. If you look at the studies that show that most of what the population actually wants doesn't get implemented, it's only really what the 1% or 10% want. That actually gets implemented as policy, I mean, and irrespective of the party. That makes me feel like the US is really a kind of oligarchy masquerading as a democracy. And that actually, I don't say that with glee, and I don't say that flippantly, and I don't say that as a conspiracy theory. I mean, you just actually look at the policy outcomes. I say that also with a great deal of regret, because I actually want well-meaning Americans to go vote. And I do think the vote matters, but it matters at the margins, and it matters in terms of temperature and rhetoric and these kind of things. But I don't think it matters as much as it should matter. And I think in the last 6 months, I think the world order has been revealed to be a little bit of theater filled with double standards and hypocrisy. And I actually think that's incredibly, incredibly dangerous for the world, for our Western values. I think it's been revealed that the rules are applied to different countries in different ways. And America's veto power and Russia's veto power and these kind of things in these world institutions is really throwing the rules-based system into disarray and kind of undermines the entire idea.
We'll have to agree to disagree. And on that charming note, what a lovely place to end this episode, Chris.
Well, I think we should actually have an episode digging this a little bit more. I think it's really important. And I think technology has played a significant role in this. And so I think it's part of the scope of the show. All right, and Ev, great chatting as always. How can people find you on the internet?
Okay, you can find me on LinkedIn, which is where I post most of my stuff. I'm on Twitter, @YBernstein. And also, if you are a founder looking to raise capital and you want some help actually refining your pitch and getting your story together, I've joined forces with a person called Sally Medelacap to start fundingfit.co, which offers small group cohort-based classes to help you really refine your pitch and get great at fundraising. Chris, how about you?
Yeah, you can find me at Chris Saad on all social media, especially LinkedIn. And you can find me on chrissaad.com/newsletter. If you're interested in working with me to help supercharge your startup and avoid dead ends and waste of time, you can learn more about my work at chrissaad.com/advisory. And don't forget, if you've listened to a few of our episodes and gotten value, you've implicitly signed up to the Startup Podcast Pact. If you believe Yanev, this is a life or death situation. And so we ask you to please subscribe and rate us in your favorite podcasting app. Subscribe on YouTube and give us a shout out on your favorite social network. It helps us grow the show and helps us help more founders.
I don't think it's a life or death situation, Chris. I think it's about the life or death of your mortal soul. Are you the sort of person who honors a pact? I think you are. I think you think you are. So get that nagging voice in the back of your head saying, what sort of person am I, out by honoring the pact? And then you can move on with your life.
Are you the sort of person that takes the trolley back to the trolley stand, or are you the kind of one that leaves it in the car park for a car to hit? Mm-hmm. All right, Yanev, catch you in the next one.
Catch you in the next one. This episode of the Startup Podcast was brought to you by Vanta. Vanta helps businesses get and stay compliant by automating up to 90% of the work for the most in-demand compliance frameworks. With over 200 integrations, you can easily monitor and secure the tools your business relies on. Head to vanta.com/TSP for 20% off their incredible offering and start unlocking extra revenue today. Stay tuned.
Just
stay tuned. Stay tuned. You happy now? Stay tuned.
Okay, that part goes at the end, Justin. After the include all of that at the end in the bloopers. All right,
shout out.
We'll talk soon, mate.